Okay, we'll call the Health and Human Service Committee, Reform Committee, to order. We are one short of a quorum just yet, but we will get started this morning with Representative McDonald and House File 865. Representative McDonald, when you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This particular bill will establish a housing support services under medical assistance to individuals with a disability age 18 or older who are eligible under certain circumstances. As you know, homelessness is a big issue in the United States, and Minnesota is no exception. And oftentimes those who are homeless happens because of their disability, be it a physical or a mental disability. So this particular bill will increase the grants or increase the funding to ensure that people can afford homes and to be put in homes. It also will extend the opportunity for those who have a disability that perhaps are in a group residential housing to be independently living, to be able to live on their own. And what that does for the state, well, what it does for the individual is more important than any financial dollar you can attach to it. It gives them sustainability, gives them empowerment, it puts them, it increases their life. It gives them joy and happiness and respect and dignity. But then financially it also saves the state taxpayers dollars as well, that they can be living independently and not necessarily in a group residential housing. So the bill does just that. I do have some testimonies or some testifiers here that are experts and are on the ground fighting and working hard for this community. And I'd like to, at this point, I think, turn it over to them to testify and speak a little bit on behalf of what this particular bill will do. And then, of course, with that, Mr. Chairman, any questions that members may have.
All right, and Representative McDonald, we do have quorum now, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. And Representative McDonald moves that House File 865 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Kelby Grovender, K-E-L-B-Y-G-R-O-V-E-N-D-E-R, and I'm the Deputy Executive Director at Hearth Connection, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to end homelessness in Minnesota. I'm here to testify in support of this bill to provide housing support services to disabled homeless individuals as a billable Medicaid service. Hearth Connection provides supportive housing to over 600 households across the state, representing over 1,300 individuals. Supportive housing is a recognized best practice in ending homelessness for those with multiple barriers to stable housing. It's the simple solution of ending homelessness by providing affordable housing combined with services appropriate to meet the needs of households who are not able to maintain housing on their own. Without housing, people remain homeless, but without services, people are not stable and lose their housing. We are currently using state funding through the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund to provide a wide range of services to support our participants, including the kinds of services described in this bill. If enacted, this bill would provide federal funding to leverage those state funds, allowing us to serve more individuals and bring us closer to ending homelessness in Minnesota. When combined with other Medicaid billable mental health services, such as targeted case management, we would be able to provide wraparound services to get people into housing and prevent them from falling back into homelessness using primarily federal funding. I've been providing supportive services for those experiencing homelessness for over 25 years, and I can confidently say that we know how to end homelessness. It's through proven best practices such as supportive housing. In supporting this bill, we're supporting the end of homelessness in Minnesota.
All right, questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Mr. Grovender, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hey. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susie Emmert-Schatz. I'm from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota and the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. The Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities represents over 40 organizations serving people with disabilities and advocating for services for people with disabilities as well. So about a year ago, the disability and housing and homelessness community came together to talk about Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance. This is a resource in the community that is really critical to people with disabilities in order to maintain their housing, find housing, and continue with their housing. So, and we also know that many people with disabilities are also experiencing homelessness, so we have quite a bit of overlap there. So what we looked at was expanding MSA housing assistance in order to help more folks who want to exit group homes and live in more independent housing, also for folks who are experiencing homelessness once they are able to get into housing, and most specifically for those youth who are transitioning from maybe their homes or other places so that they can just bypass the whole group home system and live in their own independent housing. So the proposal is endorsed by Homes for All and the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. Once the federally funded services are approved, we anticipate that we'll be able to offset all of the costs for increasing the income supplement that you're going to hear about in just a moment as well. So currently, the income support is about $194 a month for folks that are able to access this service or this support, and currently about just under 1,000 people are accessing the service, or the support, people with disabilities. Once the federal funds are approved for the services, that will offset the cost to be able to increase that income support to closer to $400 a month for individuals with disabilities and allow us to serve about 2,000 people rather than the current 1,000 people. There's a bar graph on your one-pager that demonstrates exactly what that, how that would break out for folks as far as impacting their income and being able to access housing supports and access rental properties. So these are folks who are paying about 40% or more of their income to their housing costs. So what's important to remember is that the state is already paying for these services that Mr. Govender talked about, that we are going to be, the federal government will be paying for in the future. We'll be able to serve more people, and especially we can use this as one of the levers to help turn the ship of disability services into more independent housing. So any questions for me? I'm happy to answer those.
Questions for Ms. Schatz? Seeing none. Representative McDonald, you have the A1 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
All right. Representative McDonald moves the A1 amendment to your amendment. Representative McDonald.
Let me just briefly explain what this amendment will do, and I believe it almost it replaces the next bill and combines the two together to be more efficient and effective. So this amendment updates effective dates of sections of the particular bill based on federal approval. So 9 months from the approval of the service structure, 10 months from approval of the supplemental service rates. It also updates the state standards of assistance for Minnesota receiving supplemental security income. And as Susie said, this will allow for the federal waiver that is necessary for to get those extra dollars for those who are need supplemental aid in their home. It also will save the state $1 million in doing so. It still costs taxpayers because it's our tax dollars at the federal level, but it saves the state itself $1 million in able to apply for this federal waiver. Did I articulate that correctly?
Yeah.
Good. So that's what the amendment does.
Questions to the A1 amendment to Representative McDonald? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify to House File 865 as amended? Seeing none, any final questions for the author, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, this is great stuff. It's a great idea. Heart Connection's a great organization and everything. So, but my question to you is, this is great to try to draw down extra federal dollars, but as you know, Republicans in Congress are poised to cut our dollars sharply. And now I've heard estimates as high as 40% of our Medicaid dollars. And we're not even talking about the Affordable Care Act repeal, but block granting in some way reshaping what we get from the federal government for Medicaid. So what happens to all of this if that happens? I mean, are we just rearranging the chairs on the Titanic here?
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weaving, we don't really know the future. We can only speculate and project. I believe that our good friends in the federal government, our congressmen and senators, will see to it that this is very good dollars spent to make sure that the homeless have homes. And those with disabilities can live independently and have homes as well. So perhaps there may be cuts, but I think my good friends, the fellow Republicans in Congress, will see to it that all the tax dollars that we pay into our federal government from the state of Minnesota will come back necessary to be able to house this group of people that want to live independently and get off the streets. I don't have a crystal ball to determine that, so I want to focus on the present, not necessarily a projected future that may or may not happen.
Representative Whitley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative McDonald, you know, I believe totally that you are very sincere in wanting to see these things happen. So are you contacting the Republican members of Congress that you know, at least the ones from Minnesota, to let them know that you don't want these funds to be cut?
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Levine, that's a very good question. And yes, I did last Wednesday, a week ago Wednesday, on my way out of town. I was on the road for quite some time, and I called Congressman Jason Lewis and Congressman Emmer and spoke to them regarding this issue and a couple other issues as well. I should reach out to Representative Klobuchar as well, and or Senator Klobuchar and others. Perhaps I'll do that. So thank you for the suggestion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you do, Representative Levine, bring up a very important question. Obviously, Republicans need to, or we all need to, be very conscious of our dollars spent. They're not infinite dollars to go everywhere. So it's a good thought, and I appreciate you bringing it up.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not really sure who this is for. Maybe you all have input in this. But my question is, if you're looking at some housing, and I'm thinking about rental property rather than an apartment complex type setting, will there be extra requirements? I mean, I'm seeing that there's some types of screening, but would there be something that a rental owner would have to do in order to make the house fit? And would that be something that would be, you know, you have to do it, or we would like to see it done type of thing? Thank you.
Representative McDonald?
Yeah, that's a great question, Representative Tice. Because I know many friends that have the rental properties and would be welcome, very welcoming in being able to help this cause. I believe that Mr. Grosvenor may be able to answer that question better than I.
Mr. Grosvenor.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, committee. Most folks who are using rental assistance and supportive housing, scattered site supportive housing programs like this, typically they are using either HUD or Minnesota Housing Rental Subsidies. The funds, the MSA funds that we're talking about here would be in addition to that. In order to use those kinds of rental assistance subsidies, they do have to pass quality standards inspection, but it is nothing that would be beyond what a rental property owner should be doing with their properties anyway. It's things like making sure there are screens in the windows, that the outlets are functional, that the paint is not peeling off the walls, things like that.
Representative Tice. All right, any other questions for Representative McDonald on House File 865? Any final word, Representative McDonald?
Thank you. Just briefly, just to put a little human touch to this a story that I spoke about to my colleagues here just the other day regarding a friend, Tim Zabel from Delano. He was in a group residential home at the Dells home in on Elm Avenue, not too far from my studio, and you really wouldn't know if he had a disability, but he had a disability. But nobody would know that in town. He was very brilliant in sports figures and facts. He would know every number and every score and every player that scored a touchdown in 1985 or 1995 or both at the NHL, NBL, and then local. He had a memory, brilliant, brilliant memory. And he could bring up statistics instantly. He was just a brilliant young man, my age actually, so yeah, he was a young man. But he was living in a group residential housing, but because of this program, he was able to live independently on his own home, just right across the street from the Dells group home, and was able, he fell in love, he got married, was able to live independently. And I tell you, for those community in Delano, who everybody knew him and he knew everybody, And actually, he liked to talk politics once in a while. Not many people do that, but he always would talk politics with me as well as sports. But really, for the group in Delano, with his friends, it just lifted our lives and spirits probably just as much as he. He did pass away last year of cancer. It was very, very sad. He had one of the biggest funerals in Delano, and he was a very avid baseball fan and coach, or assistant coach of the baseball teams. But really, this is what did for him, and I know it's for thousands of other Minnesotans, that gives them an independent ability to live alone, allowed him to get married, you know, fall in love, get married, and be independent, and live just like you and I. So it really is a wonderful program that the state currently has, and I just appreciate your time to listen and support this great bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. With that, Representative McDonald renews his motion that House Bill 865, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 865, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative McDonald, thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members.
All right. Next up, we will have Representative Hamilton with House File 898. And as Representative Hamilton makes his way up front with his testifiers, Representative Peterson moves the adoption of the minutes from Tuesday, February 14th. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from Tuesday, February 14th, 2017, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. I will move that House File 898 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee. So, Mr. Chairman, our testifiers couldn't be here this morning, so Representative Fisher and I will do our best to convey their message here also. But this bill was brought to us from Nikki and Daryl, and you probably recognize those names. We see them in the halls of the Capitol quite often, and they advocate for people with disabilities, amongst other things. And if you recall, a few years back, they became, right? Parents. I remember Nikki, she was very excited with both of them when they were expecting their first child, and they became parents. And Nikki brought in a beautiful little girl. She's about three now, right, Representative Fisher? She's about three. She brought the beautiful baby girl in to meet with us, and it was incredible. It's amazing. And she had an idea about this bill that we have before us, and it would establish a parenting support services. So if people have disabilities, as defined, and you can see right there, I can walk you through the bill, but if a person is receiving state services for a disability, that then they would qualify for this pilot project that we're proposing here to help with some of the child-rearing tasks. And Nikki wanted us to stress that this isn't about babysitting. It's not about raising a child, disciplinary action, or anything like that. This is just helping families do some of the tasks, the day-to-day tasks, whether it's, as you can see on lines 1.17, whether it's washing clothes, bathing the child, child-proofing the home, etc. Because one of the fears that individuals with disabilities have is that if somebody would come in and perceive that they weren't properly caring for the child, that the child could be removed from the home and rip these families apart, right? Now, again, I want to stress, in this particular case, these are two wonderful people. They absolutely love and adore their little baby girl, and they want to make sure that they properly care for them, right? They're looking out for the best interests of their child. We do not have anything like this that is currently in place. And if you go to the second page, and we talk about the supporting services that an individual is receiving, they are receiving care, and it up to 275 hours for the individuals with disabilities. What this pilot program would do is it would allow up to 40 hours per month for additional parenting services to help with that child, to keep that child in the home with their loving, caring parents. It would also form, if you go to page 3, it also form an advisory committee
made up of parents with disabilities and individuals who are personal care assistants, and then members from both the House and the Senate to make sure that we are accomplishing what it is that we are wanting to accomplish. Now, I did visit with the Assistant Commissioner, Jim Koppel, on another unrelated topic, and I brought this up to the department, and I asked for their thoughts and input as well. And it was new, of course, and he said that he'd like to take this back and visit amongst them. So this is work in progress, and if we are fortunate to have your support and move it out of the committee, we'll be able to get some of the questions answered, too, as far as cost of establishing this program. And, yeah, with that, I don't know if Representative Fisher has anything to add, but otherwise we'll stand for questions.
Representative Fisher, welcome to the committee. If you could give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Excuse me. First of all, I want to say that Nikki and Daryl are great people in our community. They live in the community I'm in. Nikki, as a matter of fact, has been very involved in serving the local commissions and task force to help people in our community, and also advocate for those that are disabled, making sure that we're removing barriers along the way. And they've been very good about identifying barriers that they've run into, that they've been very fortunate they've been able to have some people help out, that not everybody is disabled to be able to have that support. And there was actually a point in time where they went without services for about 9 months because of the crossover that was occurring as they were trying to raise their child, and the assistance they were receiving, how it sometimes that was kind of crossing over, and the way the rules were written is that the supportive people couldn't really be there because, you know, as the child was interacting, that might be a violation of rules. And they realized that could be an issue. Fortunately, they had support people they were able to go to that could help them out during that time frame. But they realized that presents a bigger problem as they're trying to raise their child that other disabled couples would run into. And their focus is trying to figure out. They knew they didn't have all the answers. They wanted to come up with the answers in a format to be able to address it so that families can stay together. And as Representative Hamilton mentioned, is one of the problems that we run into with the disabled community is when child protection comes in, sometimes they take a look at the disability as being the reason that we should be taking the child away from that home. We want to make sure that we prevent that, but we also want to make sure that we're getting the right services set up. And that's where the pilot project is very important, along with the advisory committees, making sure that we're bringing people in to create the system to make sure that we've got the appropriate supports in there to keep the family together and do the parenting in the way that is going to move the family forward. Because it's going to look real different when you've got somebody who's got a child that's 1 to 5 years old versus somebody who's got a child that's 8 to 10 years old. And the support that is needed is going to be different in those. And I think the way that it's being approached is a great way. As we say, we don't have all the answers now. That's part of the reason we've got the advisory group put together, because this is something we're going to need continued input. And the eventual goal is when we're done is that we're going to have a new system here that has got supportive services that are going to keep great families together, provide the parenting skills, and allow people to have a great quality of life that we all have as able-bodied people.
I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for this bill. I am very intrigued with it. I have a son who's disabled, and they don't have a family yet. They would love to have one and look forward to that day. But it's challenging for them. So I guess my question is, do you have any idea how many families might be affected by this in the state of Minnesota? Could benefit, I guess, would be the right way to put it, this program.
Representative Hamilton.
No, Mr. Chairman, and Representative, no, and that was one of the questions that I had asked also, and so we're looking to, I'm trying to figure out those numbers, and so I don't have an answer for you here today, but if we're fortunate enough to get out of this committee, hopefully we'll have one for you at the next one.
Okay. A follow-up, Representative Lohmer. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is somewhat related. I see this as a pilot project, which suggests to me it's not necessarily intended to serve everyone in the state who could potentially benefit from it. I guess there is a blank appropriation at the end of it, so I'm just sort of curious. I guess my question is related. Do you have an idea, how much it would cost to serve one family, and what, and I guess I am curious also, like Representative Lohmer, about the extent that people could benefit from this, because it sounds like people could definitely benefit and there is a need out there.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. As far as the dollar amounts for each individual family, it'll be based off of what we currently pay for the services that are provided under Minnesota Statute 256B for individuals who are receiving personal care assistance for medical assistance as well. So it's based off of those rates, and again, this is limited to 40 hours per month. The way it'll be set up is there'll be, if you look on lines 3.5, grants that would be established, and the commissioner will then, under 3.10, be issuing those grants out to the grantees, of course. And it says right there, they shall pay a provider, I don't have my glasses on, under the section, the same rates provided for services under Minnesota Statute Section 256B-0659. So as far as the dollar amounts per recipient, it is already in rules, okay, or in law.
All right, any other questions for the bill author? Seeing. Oh, Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Hamilton, great bill. Over the 7 years, it's been great to see Nikki and Daryl at the Capitol and visit with them. They've been very helpful and as a great resource for those with disabilities and helping us policymakers. And I'm a little disappointed they're not here for the bill. It's a very important bill, but Franz and Mary Franzen reminded me that, of course, they have a three-year-old, so that's a pretty right. legitimate reason not to be here. But, boy, when I see them, they're going to be in. But the question for you is, and I'm just going through the bill, and I didn't quite see it. I forgot my cheaters. Sometimes I need those as well. But is there a certain age? I see in the bill it says 18 years or younger. Is there a certain age that would it just wouldn't be practical that a PCA would be necessary to do the things that it says in your bill, such as lifting, carrying, doing laundry, bedding, feeding and stuff? Is there a point where perhaps the mom and dad don't need that anymore, and what triggers that to end that service under the pilot project?
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative McDonald, this is the conversation, exact conversation that we're having with Nikki. And like she said, that'll ebb and flow. You know, and when the child is an infant, of course you might need a little additional assistance. But as that child grows and becomes more self-sufficient, you're going to need less. And that's why we wanted to establish this as a pilot project and have others on that advisory committee to weigh in on this too, so that we can actually answer these questions more directly, right? Because it is going to ebb and flow. So I think that addresses your question.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Hamilton. Then lastly, most of those with disabilities that are in their housing, you know, their own housing or group residential, or their own housing, I should say, they do have a PCA. Is that correct?
Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, that is correct. And that's one of the qualifiers in order to be a recipient of this program.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. So it's really the scope of a PCA really wouldn't be that much more if they're able to take care of someone that has a disability to help around the house for a couple hours or an hour to help with the child. Doesn't seem like it's going to be that big of a pilot project. Seems very capable and something that would be hopefully attainable more easily than the first thought. Does that make sense?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McDonald, that was my initial thought also. But the way this is drafted and what Nikki was talking about is that this would be a different individual providing the service, okay? And my question was, well, can't it be one of the same? And because I'm not as, as knowledgeable in that area as Nikki and others are. And so I've been asking their perspective and also the commissioner's perspective if it couldn't be one of the same. But the bill specifically says this will be a completely separate individual that would come in and provide these services. But I think we should continue having that conversation if there's some type of crossover that could actually take place.
Chairman Dean. Okay, is there anyone else? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for either of you. So under our PCA program, as I understand it, the PCA could be a family member in some cases. So is it contemplated? I assume that right now what happens probably in a lot of these situations is that probably a grandparent is helping or other family members might be helping. would those people be eligible to be the PCA under the bill?
Representative Hamilton.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative, I would, I guess I would leave that up to the department to help make that determination also. I would say that as current law states, if whoever is qualified for the existing program, it would make sense that they too would be qualified to perform the tasks in here as set out and defined by the department, if that makes sense.
Representative Wheatley.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hamilton. I mean, I'm not, of course, I'm, you know, sometimes that can be a great thing. I mean, we learned a few years ago, I think, when there was an effort to cut off family members from being PCAs, that that was not a smart move for a lot of reasons. Sometimes the family member is the person who is absolutely best suited to provide the care, and otherwise the family would have to go to someone far less qualified or maybe without language skills. So there are really good reasons to allow that. So, you know, I just was curious about whether that would be a possibility, because I could certainly see that in cases like this, that could be a really important thing too, that it might be a family member who's absolutely best suited to give the help, and sometimes those family members just simply can't afford to do it unless there is some kind of compensation. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
No, thank you. Thank you for your comments.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? We have someone coming forward. You can have a seat, and then please state your name and give us your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm not as familiar with the committee process, but I heard of the bill on Friday. My name is James Dunn. I left a voicemail for Mr. Zerwas and Hamilton, although I may have missed a phone call. I'm not familiar with the background on this bill, but I would consider myself somewhat of an expert in the PCA program because I've lived through it for a number of years. My son is 5 years old and his mom is disabled. She has cerebral palsy and is fully constrained to a wheelchair. The first thing that kind of stood out to me on this bill was the very purpose of it is to prevent the removal of a child solely because a parent has a disability. I just want to point out that, you know, in terms of custody or placement decisions, there are specific laws in 518.17 that prevent courts or prevent services from removing a child on the sole purpose of having a disability. And you know, there's a number of examples of that in family law that says you can't remove a child solely because of a disability from a family. I would hope that DHS and CPS take that into account. Actually, I have experience with that as well. So in my case, this particular family, and I don't mean to litigate my personal cases here, but you guys are the reform committee for people, for families, for policy. And if we look at the big picture as the exception, you know, if we look at who this can help, I'm not familiar with people that brought the bill forward. There are good families. There are great scenarios where the service can help. But we have to look at the exceptions as the big picture, because if you don't, we're doing it wrong. Okay, so the scenario is if there's children involved in the family, and that family was split up for any sort of reason, they absolutely depend on PCA care for their daily lives. And our PCA program awards 10, maybe 12, maybe 11, 12. Under certain circumstances, you could get a couple extra hours per day, but it's limited. So that means that if you are disabled, if you're confined to a wheelchair or confined to a bed or confined to certain movements or capabilities, you depend on people for help. And you may not have family for help all the time. If you have children in the home, those children depend on the PCAs for help. One PCA in the federal PCA program, there's laws that prevent if that child isn't named and indicated on that form as receiving the recipient of services, it's fraud if they pick up, you know, even a bowl of cereal for those children. And I can tell you that is not a risk in the state of Minnesota, because I've reported it over and over and over, and you'll find that DHS has never investigated fraud or timing issues, paycheck issues, timesheet issues. So that's simply not a risk in the state of Minnesota. What I'd like to see happen with this bill is I'd like to see it go back. I'd like to see this committee say, you know what, we have a problem. PCA care, you know, no one in Minnesota that's disabled and can find a wheelchair chair should get 10 hours of assistance. If we have programs that help anyone else as a priority, our priorities are wrong. That if they need 24-hour care, give them 24-hour care. If that means that they need, you know, they're making a decision, do I go home and get insufficient care or do I go to a group home? We need to adjust our bills. And when I see the PCA care for children being 40 hours a month, that's 1.3 hours a week, a day. They need 24-hour care. And I can put a number on it, too. If our PCA should be making $18 an hour, and they're not, they're making 11 or 12, that means that the way that the home health care agency makes profit on that, they're mandated to pay 72.5% of their federal dollars to the PCA. So that means that we need to pay $25 an hour out of the state to pay for the PCAs. So for 24-hour care, 365 days a week, that's $220,000 for one person. So we better be prepared to spend $1 million to support five families for this program. Now, I would suggest not a dollar comes out of this reform committee until we fix child protection issues, because we're seeing it in the news. Our priorities are wrong. You know, we're seeing a lot of issues with that. And I have an issue with this as it relates to child protection and as it relates to this bill. I have a hearing on Tuesday when I get back from Disney. I'm a Disneyland dad. I forgot to mention that. We spent $600, me, this morning, because I was supposed to board a flight to Disney World with my kids for a vacation. I heard of the committee. If I would have known there's follow-up committee hearings, probably would have deferred that. But I came this morning anyway to speak about this. So, as a father, I'm struggling with my son because I am in this scenario where his mom doesn't have appropriate help and coverage for the children. Now, there are four children under the age of 10 in that home. And that home is up in the Iron Range. There's mold on the ceilings. We talked about a bill here prior to that about placement in home. In homes outside of the group homes, you know, she got a home, and I think the rent is covered by some services, but there's mold on the ceilings, and I'm not talking about a little bit. I'm talking about the ceiling will collapse in the entryway. The basement is full of mold, and not a single person out of the county or state will come in and help that. So we gotta look about that, you know, look into those priorities. So, you know, in advance of my hearing for 50-50 custody, which is coming up next week. I got an email with a packet of 26 pages of police reports on the particular household that I'm talking about. And out of here, it's directly related to the bill and the need for services. There's a number of issues. There is a domestic between the mom and the care provider, who is the boyfriend for a year. He was the PCA for 8 months until there was an assault, right? So he was arrested. And, you know, there's a number of funny ones, like a call to complain about dog poop. There's a domestic abuse report. The kid's 8-year-old called 911 to say that mom was getting beat up by the PCA. Now, why does this happen? I can tell you why this happens. And it happens because when you are dependent on PCA care for support, you have nobody else, no family, you've burnt out through your friends, you've burnt out calling anyone for help. You need immediate help and care, and you need to make sure that they're there as a mother or father with a parental disability. They can't know the law, and part of this bill says that there's appropriate training. If they have appropriate training, they're going to know that they can't touch the kids, they can't help the kids, they can't do anything for the kids. So we have a PCA Choice program in Minnesota that allows the care recipient to select their own care provider. Put an ad in Craigslist or in the local newspaper, and you say, I need help. And they come, and you hope to get the kid out of high school that's never done this before, and you say, you know what, I need help, here's a program, here's a home health care agency, I need your driver's license, social security number, and we'll do a little bit of background check. You'll start tomorrow. So they start tomorrow. The state of Minnesota takes 4 weeks to do a background check for PCAs. In that 4 weeks, that person that you just hired is already on the books, although they're not going to get paid. So they are up to, you know, this is an issue. It's related to the need of maybe the reform committee of looking at the background checks. If you can turn a background check around in 24 to 48 hours,
That would be helpful because these PCAs have been working for 4 weeks without becoming an employee of the state of Minnesota. So that's conflict of interest, right? If I complain about that, I don't get paid. If I don't do exactly what they say and help and care for these kids, I don't get paid. And so you can see the conflict of interest with that because of the way that we need reform desperately in this environment. We need the 24-hour care. We need a number of these care components. So you got PCAs that don't know if they can support the children or not. You got investigations that just simply don't get followed up by the state of Minnesota, so there's no risk there. In this case, you've got, you know, if you don't do it for me and you leave, in this particular case, I'm going to have you arrested for a vulnerable adult charge or something similar. So there's a lot of conflicting issues. What else do you do when your PCA wants to leave and go home for the day and you need a couple more hours with your kid before you get placed into a bed and they shut the door and walk out? I can tell you what you can do and where it would be appropriate for a certain child of ages. So my son's 5, he has a sister who's 7, or 2 brothers that are 8 and 10. What you do is the PCA leaves and then these little children help care for their mom in that case.
Chair Dean, excuse me, sir, I think this is probably your first time testifying, is that right?
It is.
Okay. No. One of the things that we want to do is just try to stick to the bill itself.
Right.
And so that your perceptions and what you would like to, you know, the bill itself. So I think you got a unique perspective and something to add to the bill, but, you know, we can't talk about your specific case and kind of go off in different directions. But I do think that you have a good perspective, and I'd be happy to chat with you afterwards just about kind of how to organize your testimony and how to get your point across for the best interests of what you want to bring to the committee. So I'd be happy to do that for you.
I would love to reach out to anybody that can help address any of these issues.
And, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
And I was wondering if there's somebody here from the department, maybe not to come up and testify, but to meet with him directly after, if you have time.
I do.
We have a contact here that he could share his concerns with, somebody at the department.
Chair Dean. Mr. Chair, I see Assistant Commissioner Santo up there, and I think we'll be able to circle up. Sorry, Mr.
Great. Can I add 2 points?
Mr. Dunn.
2 points is that one of the PCAs was arrested for strangling my kids. And I just read this on Friday, right? Wasn't arrested. I'm sorry. The police came over. And that person is still employed as a PCA with the health care provider, right? Multiple child runaways. So there's a need for this service. Absolutely. There's a need for reform. And I would suggest that this committee doesn't put a dollar for new programs, new pilot projects, or anything until we no longer see issues in the newspaper for child protection issues, because that hasn't been addressed. And we have a priorities issue in the state of Minnesota, significantly.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Dunn, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 898? Seeing none, are there any other questions for the bill author? All right, seeing none, I will then renew my motion that House File 898 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 898 is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next we will have Representative Albright and House File 1169. And Representative Albright moves that House File 1169 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Albright, welcome to the testifying standard. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1169 is an extension of the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission, which expired as of January 1st, 2017. This extends the bill and provides an opportunity for the legislature to speak into the issues that are relevant to health care and long-term care as well. So I have a testifier with me who would like to speak to the bill.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Dr. Megan Walsh. I'm the Chief Academic Officer at Hennepin County Medical Center. And in this capacity, I oversee all of the training of a very diverse workforce that comes through our health system. That ranges from physicians to nurses to pharmacists, physical therapists, occupational therapists. The entire healthcare team comes through our system for further training. And we have been the recipients of a really wonderful program that's come through this legislature, and I can't thank you enough for the creative, collaborative solutions that have helped to not only expand our healthcare education, but also diversify our training and incorporate creative options around curriculum to truly increase the desire to pursue primary care as a profession for physicians, as well as develop a care team that maximizes the skills and strengths of all types of healthcare providers, both for urban healthcare environments as well as rural environments. I wanted to add that although we have a consortium of healthcare training centers in the Twin Cities, 65% of the physicians who've left or graduated from our training programs in the Twin Cities have remained in Minnesota. 25% of the roughly 1,800 physicians that we've trained in the metro area have practiced or begun practices in greater Minnesota. So although we train in the metro area, we produce for the state broadly. This type of program has really allowed us to develop and grow. And with the healthcare landscape that's ever-changing, unpredictably, this type of collective thinking will help us meet all of the demands, both urban and rural, that the state faces well into the future.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Walsh, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Dr. Walsh? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jason Barron, V-A-R-I-N, and I'm a pharmacist and a faculty member with the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. Thank you for allowing me to provide some commentary today. In the essence of time, I'm here to support both House File 744 and House File 1169 with a single statement. We're the only pharmacy school in Minnesota, and we graduate doctorally prepared pharmacists or PharmDs for our state. Pharmacists are the most accessible healthcare providers and play a vital role in a team-based healthcare in Minnesota, especially in rural and underserved areas, and in clinical specialties like geriatrics and mental health. The College of Pharmacy has implemented advanced curricular changes that have helped propel us to a number two ranking out of 140 colleges of pharmacy nationwide. We've also established one of the first high-performance credentialed pharmacist provider networks to meet the current and future needs of Minnesota. We have over 200 preceptors across the state that ensure that our students receive relevant clinical training with a clear understanding of the state's communities and the citizens that they care for. The College of Pharmacy works to identify current and anticipated healthcare workforce shortages by both provider type and geography, and how we can help be a part of the care team to address these shortages. Our collaborations with GuidePoint and Brainerd and North Point's Community Mental Health Center, which serves Aiken, Cass, Crow Wing, Morrison, Todd, and Wadena counties, help address the shortage of mental health providers in greater Minnesota. College of Pharmacy evaluates the effectiveness of incentives currently available to develop, attract, and retain a diverse healthcare workforce. Our expansion of a second campus at the University of Minnesota Duluth has helped address the need for more frontline healthcare providers in greater Minnesota. The College of Pharmacy shares the goals of both HF 744 and HF 1169. We are committed as a college and as a profession to improving the health and the quality of life for all Minnesotans. We strongly supported the past work of the Healthcare Workforce Commission and very much want to be at the table as these issues are discussed in the future. We believe that pharmacy is a key and necessary component in any team-based healthcare workforce and can offer solutions that can bring access to high-quality health care to the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Barron, for your testimony this morning. Other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1169? Seeing none, questions for the author? Seeing none, final word from the author.
Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Albert renews his motion that House File 1169 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1169 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair.
Next, we will take up Representative Schultz's bill, House File 1167. And as she's making her way up, I will move that House File 1167 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Schultz, welcome to the committee. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill allows a $5,000 non-refundable. Or do you have the amendment with you? Can you move the amendment first?
Yes, there is an amendment in our packets, the A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Schultz, to your amendment.
Okay, so this is the amendment that makes the tax credit non-refundable. It's up to $5,000. And it's individuals who serve without compensation as medical preceptors. It defines medical preceptors as physicians, advanced practice registered nurses, physician assistants, or mental health professionals who serve at least 12 weeks or 480 hours as a preceptor for a student or medical resident and who received no compensation for doing so. It requires the Commissioner of Revenue to consult with the Commissioner of Health and report to the legislature by March 2021 on the number and amount of credits claimed, the geographical distribution of preceptor services, the medical profession served by preceptors claiming the credit, and the impact of the credit on the availability of preceptors. The Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission has recommended this in their final report. And if you're not familiar with the final report, I can send that around electronically. This is a report generated December 2016. I also would be happy to come back to the committee as a member of that commission to review the report on the strengthening the healthcare workforce. The commission heard from higher education institutions, employers, and training sites that the availability, sustainability, and access to clinical training sites for students is their greatest training challenge. The cost and availability of clinical sites was identified as a major bottleneck to producing more providers to meet state workforce needs. The commission heard reports of students whose graduation was delayed by as much as a full year because they could not find preceptors to complete their clinical training requirements. And the tension between revenue generation and teaching students is a challenge for preceptors. It can be especially difficult for rural providers to give up time for precepting, which takes away from the revenue stream. And I have one testifier here today.
All right, and briefly, to the amendment, Representative Albright.
Representative Schultz, in your appropriation under this bill, what would be the amount that would be reduced by any other transportation budget or health and human services budget for this credit?
Well, there is, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Representative Albright, there is a fiscal note being generated by the Department of Revenue because this bill is being heard in the tax committee in the Senate, so that they're working on that bill. Our estimate is that 500 to 1,000 preceptors will be eligible for the tax credit.
But the tax credit, Mr. Chair, the tax credit will it not directly affect any other budget or the general fund?
Representative Schultz.
That's a good question. It's not refundable, so there's not an appropriation. It will reduce our tax revenue for the state.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. I'm appreciative that each representative acknowledges that credits are a good thing. That consumers benefit directly and that it is not a direct correlation to the general fund.
All right. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. And Representative Schultz, you had a testifier for your bill?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Michael Kim. I am a physician and currently serve as the Assistant Dean for Student Affairs at the medical school. As you are likely aware, the medical school plays a significant role in providing and training the physicians that provide care to the residents of Minnesota. The Minnesota Office of Fire Education reports that 70% of practicing physicians in Minnesota have done at least part of their training either medical school or residency at the university. The medical school also has the distinction of having the second most graduates going into primary care and the largest number of graduates going into family practice, family medicine. This, however, does not come easy. There is a heavy investment by the state of Minnesota, the medical school, and physicians across the state. As co-director for a clinical course called Primary Care Selective, which I served as co-director from 2009 to 2014, it was my responsibility to oversee recruitment and scheduling of community pediatric and internal medicine pediatric clinical doctors. Through our Duluth camp, so we, I covered those two areas, and then we had other directors who covered other specialties, including family medicine and internal medicine. And then through our Duluth campus, we also have a role, physician associate program that puts students in clinic community preceptors across the state. So these preceptors, who basically physicians working in a clinic who take students, allow them to see their patients in a supervised manner, take the time to show them what it means to be a primary care doc, and provide them basic education in practicing medicine. For the vast majority of these clinical community faculty, there is no compensation other than that they get a designation of adjunct faculty and a few minor perks that come along with that, such as an email address at the university. So currently there are roughly 500 preceptors across the state who do this in some capacity. Some of them are very active in doing this almost all year round. Many of them are doing this very part-time, some of them only a month or two in a year. On any given day, we have approximately 60 students who are working in these community preceptor clinics or hospitals. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, it's been very challenging to recruit and to maintain these preceptors. Although when we talk with these preceptors, they are very engaged and very interested in training medical students, but for many of them, it's just an impossible task. In a study from 2014, it was noted that the top reasons why clinical preceptors, this was from across the country, clinical preceptors did not want to have students was, number one, lack of time, number two, increased demands and productivity expectations, number three, reimbursement of care disincentives, number four, low confidence or self-interest in teaching, and five, barriers related to electronic health records. And it's been was our experience that all these have gotten worse over the years, and especially the competition with electronic health records. In some cases, clinics are saying they don't even have a computer space for it to put students. So although compensation appears to be relatively low compared to other barriers, it is still a significant barrier. Other programs have had success with incentivization, especially in the northeast of the United States. Many programs use financial incentives to primary care preceptors in order to encourage them to participate. And in our area, we have seen competition from advanced practice provider training programs that do provide some compensation to preceptors for training. From the University of Minnesota perspective, we will, of course, will continue to do all we can to engage health systems. We have had wonderful help from the Minnesota Medical Association, and we know we have a lot of very interested individuals out in the community who want to provide education in primary care. But we certainly appreciate any help the state can provide to incentivize participation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kim, for your testimony this morning. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. In Minnesota, as you know, a lot of our physicians work in large health systems. And so if they are able to take time, if their system allows them to take time to be a preceptor, and they I assume many of them probably don't lose compensation for taking that time. And so how does this work for those people?
That's great. Thank you for that question. Mr. Chair and Committee, basically what happens when someone's working in a large system, perhaps salaried, may have productivity goal benchmarks. Typically, they're not having any reduced salary per se, but typically they are spending 45 minutes to an hour more time in their clinical day when they have a student in their clinic or in, along with them.
Representative Levine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this gives them some personal incentive to spend the extra time that they wouldn't get extra compensation for, I'm assuming. So that's fine. So, and Representative Schultz, you know, I think this is a really critical problem. I in no way, I'm really aware of this. This is a problem that we don't have enough preceptors. One of the things, though, as this moves to the tax committee, and I see we have some tax staff in the room. In the code, in the statutes, there is a provision that I had a lot to do with putting there. That's why I know about it. That requires new tax expenditures to have a purpose statement. And part of the purpose statement, and maybe the staff can come up and explain a little more, but it needs to have something, goals, and some way that it's going to be measured. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm not a big believer that this is a really a good way to incentivize people, but, you know, I'm open to that. I'm open to whatever works, okay? But when we put stuff in the tax code, more tax expenditures, one of the problems with using the tax code is that we never look at it again. Mm-hmm. So something can go in the tax code and be there for years and years and years, and nobody ever says, did this actually work? We do that with so many things. So that's the purpose for that piece of statute that's there, and actually it is violated a lot. Mm-hmm. But really, I think something like this that could be thought of as a pilot program, I don't think the bill's written as a pilot program. Maybe I'm wrong.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Levine, thank you for that question. So, four other states have implemented something very similar, and they have given us more anecdotal information while they're evaluating the quantitative data, and it looks like it's been effective. And we, in the bill, is written that we will, this is goes through 2020, the effective for tax years up to 2020, and in the bill there is a report due that will look at whether or not this is effective. I'm not familiar with the statute on the purpose, but if someone from Nina could talk about that if you want more information on that statute.
Right, Mr. Chair.
Representative Levine.
So thank you for that. So, yeah, I mean, it's good to have a report, but actually the way that this provision is written, and maybe Ms. Mancy could come up and just remind the committee or tell the committee for members who have never served on taxes exactly what that is, but we should be evaluating it. And there should be a purpose statement in it, and I hope that as it moves forward, you would consider putting one in so that it actually complies with statute. It may very well get taken out at the end because, from what I've understood in the past, the Senate wasn't quite as committed to the idea of having the purpose statements in there as maybe the House was. But I certainly would want to see that in there as it moves forward. So maybe could Ms. Mancy come up, Mr. Chair, and just remind us?
Certainly. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Mancy. If you could please state your name for the record and help us out with this bit of conversation.
Mr. Chair, Nina Mancy from the House Research Department. There is a requirement in Chapter 3 of statutes that any provision that extends, renews, or enacts a tax expenditure is required to have a purpose statement that or a statement of intent that states the purpose of the tax expenditure and then provides some goals or other measures against which its effectiveness may be measured. That provision in statute doesn't require that bills that are introduced include a purpose statement, but rather that tax expenditures that are enacted into law include the purpose statement. when I, and I need to apologize to Representative Schultz, I did work with her on the amendment to this bill, and I could have taken that opportunity to draw her attention to this purpose statement requirement and offered her the, you know, opportunity to add one. When I work with legislators in drafting things that would require a purpose statement under that statute, I try to point it out to them and give them the opportunity to include a purpose statement in a bill as introduced, and they, you know, may choose to do so or not do so. What typically has happened since that purpose statement requirement was enacted is that some legislators choose to include them in bills. It's sort of their opportunity to go on record as saying what the purpose of a bill is. Many do not, and in that case, what generally happens is that it, during the tax conference committee, the conferees decide on which provisions to include in the tax bill, and at that time they add a section that provides the purpose statements for all of those provisions, whether they had one from the original bill as introduced or not.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Appreciate that information.
All right. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Representative Schultz. Currently, we have a loan forgiveness program in Minnesota, and both, I think that the preceptors are, the question is, do preceptors qualify, right, under your bill, will they qualify for an additional loan forgiveness?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, they would if they met the eligibility criteria, but for, I think, ideally, we want preceptors that have been practicing for longer time, and they may have already paid off their loans. So Dr. Kim might have more to add to that question, but I think they would qualify for also for loan forgiveness. There's nothing to exclude them from that in this bill.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Schultz. So you just said that some of these preceptors will be practicing for quite some time, so they're experts in their field and probably making hopefully a decent living financially and otherwise. So is this necessary if a practitioner or a preceptor has been practicing and successfully for some time, according to your statement? Is it necessary?
Representative Schultz.
Well, we, Chair, Representative, we hope that it's an added incentive to compensate them when they're not getting compensated for their time, and that it was easier to make a trade-off to reduce the number of patients they see to take on a student, to train a student. So we hope that it's an effective tool because we've seen a decrease in the number of preceptors for primary care, especially in greater Minnesota. So this is a recommendation that is coming from the Healthcare Workforce Commission as one method, in addition to the other things we piloted and have attempted and have currently being implemented, another tool to see if it's effective and do an evaluation.
All right. And Dr. Kim, did you have any follow-up to add to that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I would say that in the healthcare practices that the way healthcare is delivered now, preceptors have less and less sort of discretion time. We can see, especially with the addition of electronic health records, the amount of time that physicians are staying later, working from home, completing documentation, basically get more and more crunched for time. And so, again, the greater and greater disincentives to participate in something like this. I would say that many primary care doctors are working at the lower end of the reimbursement rates for providers. You know, they're not the neurosurgeons or the orthopedic surgeons who are making very large sums of money. In fact, they're often working, I shouldn't say, you know, they're still making good salaries. There's no poor physicians out there. But, you know, compared to things that you might be thinking about in terms of physician salary, and they often have very large debts, even with potential loan forgivenesses, they're also having very large debts that they're paying off.
Thank Representative
you.
McDonald.
Thank you. Then lastly, Representative Schultz, on the surface and just looking at the bill, I think it's a good idea. Minnesota is a high-tax state. We're in the top 10 high-taxed in the nation for income tax, for property tax, for commercial industrial property tax, for sales tax. So any tax credit, since I sit on the tax committee and I'm all for. So I think it has some pretty good merit. So that's all I have.
All right. Any other questions for the bill author? See none. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1167? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist representing the Minnesota Psychological Association. I just want to remind the committee that this bill also would impact mental health professionals. And as you know, we have a tremendous workforce issue with mental health in our state, and this would provide support for the supervision that students need, especially in smaller communities and rural settings. And I think we've really struggled to find ways to support ways to give the kind of we call them supervisors, not preceptors, but to support supervisors so that students can get the training they need. And this is just seems like a really what my math teachers used to call an elegant solution to a really difficult problem. So.
Thank you. And what was your last name again? I'm sorry.
Stark.
Stark. Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Stark, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Dr. Stark? Seeing none. The committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against House File 1167? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author?
No.
Final word, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I just want to point out two letters that should be in your packet, one from the Minnesota Medical Association in support of the bill, and one from Dr. Mackin of Alina Health in support of the bill. I want to thank you for hearing the bill and for your questions. I would love to come back here and talk about the commission's report. I know that Senator Benson did that in her committee over in the Senate. Thank you.
Well, Representative Schultz, we do have a couple minutes before Representative Albright gets back if you want to give us some highlights unprepared.
Okay. let's see. Well, I think the point of the last testifier was really important, that we do have an issue of not having sufficient numbers of mental health professionals in our state, and we're seeing this come about as a crisis in many communities, especially my community, and in greater Minnesota. So some of the highlights, we have many, many recommendations to help address the workforce need. And I hope that you will support Representative Albright's bill to continue this work that we're doing with our legislators and our healthcare professionals. The recommendations in the report, we have more recommendations to do more research. Right now, our institutions that help train our healthcare professionals are not able to give us sufficient information on tracking preceptors and studying why they may no longer be interested in being a preceptor. So we need to start working with these institutions to help collect information and to report back to us on the number of preceptors and the barriers going forward. We want to make sure that the committee and the legislature is reviewing the effectiveness of MERC funding for our spending, and that we consider other models for graduate medical education funding. We're seeing a reduction in federal funding to help train our healthcare professionals, which is a real concern, and a reduction in the ability and the willingness for healthcare systems to subsidize training of healthcare professionals. So that's going to make things much worse in our state. The challenges in recruiting and retaining the range of nursing education, skill, and experience needed in the long-term care settings. So I'm grateful for your work, Chair, in long-term care. We need to be able to encourage and provide more incentives for nursing education programs and higher education systems to maintain a balance between an associate and a baccalaureate registered nurse degree programs. So both levels of nursing graduates will remain available to meet our workforce needs in long-term care settings. And to encourage nursing education programs to consider reinstating the requirement that licensed PNs and registered nurse students become certified as CNAs. Another recommendation is that the legislature should monitor implementation of the 2015 telehealth parity law and state-funded broadband grants to track progress and barriers to the growth of telehealth to meet health workforce needs. Another recommendation is for the legislature to strongly consider the recommendations of the 2015 Mental Health Workforce Summit that have not become law. There was the 2016 Governor's Mental Health Task Force, the Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Department of Health, to work with the steering committee responsible for Mental Health Workforce Plan to ensure progress on those recommendations. Other additional future considerations for recommendations, identify current and anticipated healthcare workforce shortages by both provider type and geography. And we would like this to be led by MDH and other entities engaged in healthcare workforce data collection, and have them establish a formal structure to coordinate and integrate the collection and analysis of health workforce data to provide us and policymakers more information and analysis. We would like MDH to explore measurement approaches to documenting workforce shortages that capture indicators such as wait times for appointments, Minnesota scope of practice variations, and to better reflect the full range of professions in Minnesota's healthcare workforce, in addition to using federal health professional shortage area indicators. Another charge for the commission and future recommendations are to look at the effectiveness of our incentives that we currently have to develop, attract, and retain a highly skilled healthcare workforce. To look at this charge, the priority recommendations to study alternative incentives that attract and retain highly skilled workforce. We could look at public-private partnership opportunities to develop and attract a healthcare workforce. Work better with our higher education institutions in online delivery programs for certification. You want me to continue now that Representative Albright is here? This is not how I would present the report. I'd have a really nice slide deck with pictures and graphs. But there are a lot of excellent recommendations, but also really good data and charts to look at what's been happening over time with the aging workforce and in various healthcare professions. And we see a real problem with our MDs aging out quicker than our PAs, for instance. But you can see what we think will happen over time in our forecasts in the report itself, which I'll make sure I'll send around. And Representative Albright can further talk about the Workforce Council and other work of the Healthcare Workforce Commission. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz, especially for the impromptu speech you were able to give us there. Very much appreciated by the committee. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1167, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1167, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Taxes. Next, we have Representative Albright back. And Representative Albright moves House File 743 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Albright moves the A1 amendment. Representative Albright, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair and the members, the A1 amendment provides for the opportunity for pharmacy programs to be included in the grant program. I do have a testifier on task to speak to this if, at your discretion, you would prefer.
All right. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 744 establishes a grant program for eligible health care professional sites, commonly referred to as clinical training sites. Minnesota health care workforce shortages have been well documented in previous presentations to this committee. The Legislative Health Care Workforce Commission report in 2015 identified workforce shortages and presented solutions which you supported by expanding physician residency and loan forgiveness opportunities. Clinical sites and related training are essential to train the Minnesota healthcare workforce. Clinical hours are a requirement for licensing and provide real experiences in patient care under the supervision of a licensed professional. House File 743 creates a grant program to expand clinical training facilities and sites for physician assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, and other mental health professionals, now to include pharmaceutical care. The Workforce Commission received testimony from both students and training institutions and learned of the challenges in providing the training sites needed to develop the skills required to begin their practice. This lack of clinical training sites has led to a delay in graduation for some students, I might add. Minnesota needs a strong healthcare workforce, that is without a doubt. Grant opportunities in this bill will begin to address the need for additional clinical sites by providing support to the 10 to 15 programs that we envision will be participatory in this program each year. With that, I will stand for questions, and I believe I might have a testifier.
Okay, questions for the bill author on House File 743. Seeing none, is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 743 as amended? Well, with that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 743 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 743 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Finally today, Representative Albright moves House File 744 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 744 is the Healthcare Workforce Council. It's a recommendation made by the Bipartisan Healthcare Workforce Commission. Several sections have been already adopted, including the Loan Forgiveness and Physician Residency Program. In the 2015 report to the legislature, the Workforce Commission documented healthcare workforce shortages and also challenges faced with an aging and diverse population, as well as rural areas that face recruiting and retaining health professionals at all levels. The Council's focus is to monitor healthcare workforce supply, demand and distribution, cultural competency, and diversity. Three primary functions of the Council found in Section 1, Subdivision 1 are as follows. To provide an ongoing healthcare workforce policy and program monitoring and coordination. Gather and analyze healthcare workforce education and training trends, changes in healthcare delivery, practice and financing, as well as make recommendations to public and private efforts to address identified workforce needs. Subdivisions 2 and 3 identify Council membership and terms. Subdivision 4 contains reporting requirements and the development of an annual state health care workforce plan beginning in 2020. Subdivision 5 is the appropriation. And with that, I do believe I have an addendum testifier that would like to speak to this bill additionally.
Okay, if that testifier could make their way to the table. Welcome back to the committee. If you could please state your name again for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi, Jason Verna from the College of Pharmacy as well as a community practitioner. I'd just like to voice my support for this bill and the support it gives to providing health care, better health care to the citizens of Minnesota.
All right, are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you again for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the bill author? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Albright, currently there's much discussion in the education committees, K-12 and higher ed, about the lack of skilled labor in our state and how we've done away with good skilled labor of construction workers, electricians, plumbers, et cetera, et cetera. So in the commission study, has it been evident that they've been working with the schools, even from middle school, to encourage people to go into the healthcare professions like we too now are recognizing with the lack of the skilled labor? You know, speaking with many folks, I do a lot of senior photos, so I talk with the juniors that are going into their senior year, and oftentimes you'll have people go into the nursing, seems to be a big one, but... seldom do you find someone going into a practitioner or a medical field other than nursing. So is this something that is a discussion that can be happening even in the middle school and throughout high school as well?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, thank you for the question, and I think it's an excellent one. You know, when you reflect upon the need for folks to, even as you submit in elementary and the junior highs, to the career that they might launch into as they get older. The commission is absolutely tasked with that as well, to reflect upon not only the career paths, but how you get there in terms of the educational aspects of making sure you're ready for that vocation. And I might add that it isn't just about a four-year degree or a postgraduate degree, but, you know, kind of getting on that merge ramp onto the career highway, whether it be through a certification program, through a two-year degree, so that there are smaller steps as opposed to the larger step, and the commission is absolutely focused on those as well.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, lastly, I think it's evident that those who are going in the medical field, especially a doctor, that the daunting task of 8 years plus a residency and the expense is quite consuming and alarming, and probably scares off a lot of people. So I would imagine that that discussion has to be robust, and to encourage kids that really that length of time is goes in a flash the older you get. So what's your thoughts on that, Representative Albright?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. You know, we've heard a number of bills come through this committee over the last couple of weeks that speak specifically to the aging demographic in our society, and on the other end of the spectrum, speaking to those that are most vulnerable amongst us with the child care. And those two, I think, point out the crises that we have at both ends of the spectrum and how we fulfill our obligation to both those demographic groups in terms of support as well as nurturing a quality of life that they espouse to in the later years, but also get them ready for a career and to be productive citizens within our society. So I think the commission is tasked with a very, very daunting responsibility. Very robust in conversation. That's why we're looking forward to continuing the conversation.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright, for moving this forward. We certainly have an issue, and I am going to echo the comments made by Representative McDonald about making sure our at least our secondary post, you know, our secondary schools are involved in this conversation, and luckily a lot of our schools are taking steps in that direction, which I think is a good thing. But I was curious how the intent of this council overlaps or works in conjunction with the Healthcare Workforce Commission.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, and Representative Peterson. That's an excellent point of conversation as we move forward. I think that in some cases they complement each other, but in others they are overlapping. And so as the conversation ensues, as we move both these bills through the various committee structures, it's very likely that one might supersede the other, but in the juncture in terms of in the arena of competitive ideas, we're bringing both forward and moving them forward until we make a determination in terms of which one is the more viable of the two.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually kind of a related question to Representative Peterson's. I just noticed on line 2.19 of the bill that one member of the proposed workforce council is appointed by Health Force Minnesota. Wasn't totally sure who that was, so I looked at it, I Googled it here, and found it. It certainly sounds like a relevant organization. I'm a little unclear if it's a government organization or a nonprofit from looking at their description, and just also curious if you know, if there's a risk that this proposed council would be duplicative with them as well.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, I don't have the specific answer to your question right now, but as I stated with my response to Representative Peterson, I think as we move forward, the duplication we will want to alleviate and make sure that we have a robust council or commission, if that's the case, that addresses these issues in as comprehensive a manner as possible.
Representative Freiberg.
Thanks. I may follow up with the question then in government operations. That's probably an appropriate question for that committee anyway.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, there's a lot of discussion about need and we have all these gaps, but have you analyzed existing programs that have been around and developing and expanding through the past decades? I remember back when I was a youth, we had Explore Posts that were involved with, like the Mayo Clinic, and medical professionals that got students in the schools exposed to the paths. We also have multiple things for decades at RCTC, Winona State, and now UMR, which covers a vast gamut of medical professional certificates, licenses. I mean, it basically hits the whole sphere, with the exception of we have a very limited amount of pharmacy and some of the specialty. So how has the organizations that we've been discussing in this, the expansion of looking at what we have, cross-pollinating what works, and having discussion and review there so that when we go forward, we expand with things that were successful and hopefully can be more successful in the future.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I think that you raised some very salient points to the conversation that we will take up in the commission, if that is the one that moves forward, or the council. We live in a very dynamic healthcare state and nation, and with regard to what's happening in Washington, what's happening in this state relevant to the reformation or the rehabilitation of our own healthcare workforce, I think the regulatory environment is one that we'll look at. I think, reaching back into the school system with outreach to endear them to occupations and to catch a glimpse for what a career might be in a life of serving others in the healthcare and medical fields is one worthy of our work and endeavors on either one of those commissions. And so I would hope that this committee would find support for that as we move forward.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Albright, as I'm looking through the language of the bill, one thing that you may want to consider adding is the idea of telehealth and broadband access, especially in greater Minnesota, and our capacity to make sure that our healthcare facilities have secure linkages. And likely they do, but I want to make sure that they do, especially when I think about the aging population and how we're going to make sure they're getting excellent care in the decade or two ahead, that might be a thing for this group to consider. Just are we prepared and licensed as providers to deliver in that mechanism, and is the state of the technology adequate to meet the need? Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Representative Murray, so noted, and I think it has great merit, so I appreciate your comments.
Any final questions for Representative Albright this morning on House File 744? Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you for your consideration this morning.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 744 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 744 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Albright. Our next meeting will be next Tuesday, and members, you should plan to be here in the evening that day. So with that, we are adjourned.